the date?
When was the date? Well, Yeshua lived right after Moshe. You want the year? I have to figure it out. But
about 1200.
Yeah, it was 3,000 years ago. Yeah, 3,500 years ago. The simple meaning of Adiyom Hazeh is just the date the book was written. There's the date it was written, and but on the other hand, allegorically, it could also apply to our situation. Now, we don't have the Yebusites, right? The Palestinians are not the Yevusi. They are from Yishmael, but nevertheless, maybe there's a remez, because the reference to Yevusi is referring to Yushalayim primarily, that there will always be this foreign presence in Jerusalem, Ad Hayom Hazeh. Perhaps there is an allusion. So there might be double meanings in a lot of these verses. Yeah.
I'm wondering, did the Dilonim maybe want a better deal? They didn't like Kriyat Shalom because they would have had to live under the Noahite laws. Maybe they didn't want to do that. They wanted more equal.
Yeah, but here's the problem. It depends how you understand it. The problem is that the deal they got required that they live under the Noahide laws, meaning to say
they didn't get a better deal
than they would have gotten had they told the truth.
But I thought that they had a treaty that it made them more equal.
Well, even the treaty, remember, the treaty was they wanted to live in Israel. So if their treaty was they wanted to be citizens. On the other hand, there was a mutual protection treaty, which maybe a Ger Toshav wouldn't have gotten, meaning we'll come to your aid, etc. Now, I just want to digress a little bit to fill in some aspects of this. Because, as we say, the book of Yoshua is divided into two parts, really. The first part is Kibush, the story of the conquest. The second part is the story of the division of the lands. Which actually indicates the boundaries of the tribes, and that is called Chiluk or Chaluka. Right? So there's Kibush, conquest, and there's Chaluka, division. And we began discussing the division briefly. The division itself was quite complicated. If you look at it, you will see there are many, many place names and cities that are mentioned for each tribe. Both the boundaries, in other words, the way the boundaries are described is boundary cities, telling you could draw a line between A, B, C, etc. And then there's a lot of internal cities that are within the boundaries that are given, etc. However, as is always the case with biblical geography, there is tremendous, tremendous uncertainty. I mean, you look at a map and somebody draws Yehuda's here and Yisachar's here, but a lot of it is essential guesswork. I mean, we do know Yehuda's south and Yisachar is north and Zvulun is north, etc. But the exact configuration based on place names is totally a matter of conjecture. We know where Yerushalayim is, more or less, but even that's more or less. You know, we still don't have definitive boundaries for the ancient Yebusi city. Everything else, Hebron, a few places, but most of the places are certain. And one has to remember, too, that places that have the same name as the biblical sites are not necessarily on the biblical sites. So we'll get into the Chalukah a little later, but I do want to add some comments about the conquest that I don't think we talked about yet.
Pardon my ignorance. Kriyat Shalom, is it a kuf or a k?
A kuf and an aleph.
Yeah,
although this is a fascinating homonym pun, because if you spell Kriyat Shalom with an ayin, that means the ripping up of Shalom.
I know that.
So one wonders if we have Kriyat Shalom with an aleph or Kriyat Shalom.
Reading,
calling, likros, the call. It also means to read, but Vayikra El Moshe is to call out. So Kriyat Shalom is to call out and offer peace. Right, so that's an interesting part for us. Peace is also right. Peace, P-E-A-P-I-E. Right, so everything is, these words tend to connect with each other. What do they say? So Hebrew is God's language, and they say God has a sense of humor, so he kind of puts in these double meanings and things. But I want to mention a few comments about Kibush, which might be relevant even to today. And that is, there's a general machloket. I mentioned already Kriyat Shalom, the argument between Rambam and Ravid. But there's another argument between Rambam and Ramban, Maimonides and Nachmanides, regarding the mitzvah of living and settling in the land of Israel, even today. And this is at least a piece of information people should know about, if for no other reason than to feel guilty. And that is there a biblical commandment, a Torah law, to live in the land of Israel?
Yeah. You're not supposed to live it even.
It's a good thing, nice thing, it's a noble thing, but is it a mitzvah? Is there a real mitzvah? So here we have the opinion of Nachmanides, not Maimonides, Nachmanides, Rav Moshe ben Nachman, who lived in the beginning of the 13th century, shortly after the... His life overlapped with Maimonides, but most of his life was after Maimonides' death. And Ramban writes, we know that Maimonides wrote a book called Sefer HaMitzvot that lists all the mitzvot. Nachmanides wrote comments on that book in which he supplemented Maimonides' list of commandments. And in one of the supplementary commandments that Nachmanides adds to Maimonides' list is a mitzvah that is called Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, living in the land of Israel. Of course, you understand that you have a problem here, because if there are only 613 commandments, whenever you add one, you got to take away another one. So Nachmanides works it out. Sometimes the way you take it out is you combine things. You combine things that are counted as two, combine them. Whatever, Nachmanides figure out how to do it. But he did claim there is an additional mitzvah in the Torah called dwelling in the land of Israel. And this is based on a verse at the end of the book of Numbers. Remember, all mitzvot have to be in the five books of the Torah, not from the prophets. And it says, V'yirishtem ota v'shaftem ba, you shall inherit it, and v'shaftem ba, you shall dwell in it. This is a mitzvah, says Nachmanides, not only for the Jews who are under Yehoshua's leadership, but this is a mitzvah in all generations. Even when there's no Beit HaMikdash, even when there's no king, even when there's no Mashiach, there's a mitzvah. Now, Nachmanides then goes on and says that this mitzvah has four subcategories. In other words, what do we mean by yishuv? There are four components. Component number one is there's a mitzvah to conquer by force of arms, if necessary, all land that is within the biblical boundaries of Eretz Canaan. A mitzvah of conquest. Now, if you consider, as I said before, that the land of Israel... Now again, this is just Nachmanides. I'll mention, remember, Maimonides will have another view on this. I'll come back to that. But let's just focus on Nachmanides for a second. Ramban. If you consider that the boundaries of the land of Canaan, the Canaanite land, does go essentially from the Euphrates River till the Nile River, or at least the Sinai. There's a question of what Nachal Mitzrayim. Nachal Mitzrayim means the Egyptian stream. There is a machloket how far to the south that goes, but at least to the Wadi El Arish it does go, certainly. So then the issue would not be, do we give back the West Bank? The issue is we should go out and conquer the East Bank and Syria and a lot of other things. This is the first component, a mitzvah of conquest. Again, I will go back to the other views to be complete. Then he says there's a component number two, and that is there's a mitzvah not only to conquer territory, but to settle it and develop it and make it productive in whatever way that we can do so. Now, that, by the way, is a very interesting mitzvah which we can fulfill vicariously. Mm-hmm. And that is very true. When a person contributes to the JNF or plants trees or whatever it is, one is fulfilling a component of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael by making the land more beautiful. In other words, cultivation can be in many ways, by industry, by population, by agriculture, whatever it is, but it should not be shmama, it should not be desolate or left empty or left unproductive. In fact, one might even argue every time, you know, one of the things that minor things or major things that people often get upset about is the amount of garbage in the streets in Eretz Yisrael. Whatever, they're not as environmentally conscious as we are in the United States. One might say that every time you pick up a piece of garbage from the street, one is fulfilling Yishuv Eretz Yisrael by beautifying the land in some way. Yeah.
Somebody was reprimanded why he does not have the mitzvah to be in Israel.
Right.
He says, oh, I have a house, and I call it Tel Aviv in Michigan. He says, better you should have a house in Israel and call it Tel Aviv.
But that's the second component of Yishuv, is to make it inhabitable or productive. Now then there's a third, this is all Ramban, a third component, which is an amazing prophecy, prophetic declaration. He says, it is forbidden for the Jewish nation to regard any country as a national homeland other than the land of Israel. Now, this is totally prophetic. Like, what is the Rabban possibly referring to? Well, he's referring to Uganda, right? When Theodore Herzl was willing, because of the difficulties of negotiating with the Ottoman Empire, right? The Ottoman Empire was a very difficult empire to negotiate with anyway. They were the sick man of Europe. In fact, they say the Ottoman Empire was so corrupt that one half of the empire were paid spies on the other half of them. I mean, basically, like everybody was spying on everybody and trying to get a bribe, you know, getting bribes and everything else. But whatever it is, Herzl was willing, as you know, to accept Uganda. I remember reading, although I have not ever seen this said somewhere else, but at least in one source I read, that Galveston, Texas, which at that time was an island that was not connected to the mainland, was going to be given to the Jewish people as, I don't know how many Jews could fit in Galveston, Texas, as a homeland. Stalin, in his generosity, was willing to create a Jewish homeland. I mean, well, there's Siberia, but I mean, he actually had an official place where Jews could, yeah, that's right. Yeah, but the point is that Ramban's point is that Jews might live in other places, but a Jew cannot regard his country, as it were.
I know you can't go into the head and the heart of these men, but right. Why didn't these men go down to Israel if they really believed this so strongly?
Yeah, I'll discuss that. In fact, let me get to the fourth, I'll get back to that, because that's a paradox. Ramban himself did eventually go to Israel, but only when he was in his 70s, shortly before his death.
I'm not positive that Herzl would regard Uganda as a homeland, but maybe as a temporary. I think he viewed it as a temporary refuge.
Certainly Herzl's not that we had emotional attachment to let the divine presence bring us back to Uganda. I mean, we weren't. I think that's right. Of course,
some fantasy. I mean, you know, look at it the other way. He did have quite a vision of the death persecution status of Jews in Europe.
Yes. Of course. And again, I mean, Herzl's motives, I think, were very, very, very pure. But as you know, I mean, Herzl at some point was so, you know, fixated and convinced about the need of a homeland that he was willing to even suggest mass conversions. He wanted to make a deal with the Pope that if the Pope would use his good offices to let Jews settle in Palestine, he said he offered the Pope he'd bring all the important Jews of the world who would convert to Catholicism. I mean, that's really how... Absolutely. That is really... Now, again, you know, his motives, you know, we could assume were good. But he felt that this notion of the homeland would override almost everything.
You may have been crazy.
Well, okay, whatever. he did have syphilis. But okay. In fact, there's a whole argument, by the way, even how to train. Right now in Israel, again, everything's been overshadowed by the military problems. But there is a whole argument about the concept of the post-Zionist society. There really is a tremendous crisis in will. In which many Hazoni's book and you know many very prominent intellectuals do not feel in their heart of hearts that a Jewish state is even morally defensible. And that's why there's kind of a lack of will, and the Arabs, the Palestinians, exploit that lack of will, because even though you know their power as Palestinians is infinitely smaller than Israel, just looking at it in isolation, but you know they recognize that there's a failure of will, and now is a very good time to move.
This is besides the story that you told us about the prisoner.
Well, it's connected to that. But it was besides that issue, because that issue was more of a religious thing. But now, even secular Zionism is undergoing a tremendous crisis, because from a secular perspective, many intellectuals, like in South Africa, you know, regard Israel as a racist structure. And according to Yoram Hazoni, who wrote a book on this whole idea, he says that this starts now, that you know, he blames it on Martin Buber for some reason. He has to think about Martin Buber. Martin Buber basically was the enemy, and eventually, after 50 or 60 years, all of Martin Buber's disciples are now the leading intellectuals of the State of Israel. And therefore, that's the attitude, that kids in first grade, kindergarten, are no longer being taught about the glories of 1948. They're just being taught about, you know, they're being taught about how the Jews persecuted. You know, so it really changes the whole mindset. And, Well, part of it is because of Hazoni's book.
The leftist so-called leading intellectuals are not universally accepted as such, but there is now a group of people.
that way.
Well, we'll see. But part of it is because Hazzoni's book has gotten a tremendous amount of publicity.
What's the name of the book?
The Soul or Spirit of Israel?
I don't remember. But it's been a very, very well publicized book, and I think it embarrassed a lot of people in Israel. So I can imagine that they're responding to that book. But one of the little debates in this post-Zionist culture is, how do you translate? Herzl's book, setting out his view of the Jewish state, is called the Judenstaat. And there's a machlokes. Should that be translated the Jewish state or a state of Jews? Because part of the idea of the Jewish state connotes the notion that the state should be one of Jewish values. Whether, you know, not necessarily Orthodox, but at least Jewish values. A state of the Jews just means the Jews happen to be the population, but there's no reason why it should be a Jewish state. Like, why should you have a hatikva? Why should you talk about the heart of the Jew? Right? In fact, there is a movement in some extreme fringes to abrogate the hatikva as the national anthem, and to even put a crescent alongside a Jewish star in the Israeli flag. You know, the things that are going on, I mean, again, our minds are preoccupied with the external enemy, but we have to realize that the internal machloket within the Jewish people, both on religious secular issues and in terms of what is a Jewish state, is very, very, very profound. And it creates grave dangers. And the truth of the matter is the Palestinians are in an excellent position to exploit that moral weakness in terms of perceiving a Jewish state, because history does show, as the American Revolution shows, that a small group of people who are committed to an ideal will be able to vanquish much more powerful nations. Because that's normally been, you know, the story of the Jews. Israel versus the Palestinians. Of course, I'm not ignoring the fact that you also have these millions and millions of Arab countries, but at least within Israel, Palestinians are a small group, and yet, unfortunately, they are committed, even if their cause is immoral, but they are committed to their cause in a way that might be stronger than many Jews are committed to their cause. And that's a very, very disturbing and frightening thing. So, if you're interested, I think the Hazzoni book is an excellent book to read. Many say that he overstates and over-exaggerates and paints an extremely bleak picture. You mentioned people are perhaps responding to that and changing it, but at least some of what he says is very, very interesting and disturbing. But that's really the Ramban's third point, that the Jews have to regard Israel as their national home. This creates... Now, let me mention the fourth component. Now, the fourth component is the one that's the individual component. And that is, Ramban says, every Jew is supposed to live physically in the land of Israel. It doesn't say the state of Israel, the land of Israel. Eretz Yisrael, it's a faculty of Eretz Yisrael, unless you have...
I thought that was the second declaration.
No, the first one is conquest. The second one, the second one doesn't, it's not live. The second one is to settle and make it inhabitable and productive and cultivate. That's the settled, yeah. The third is to regard it as the national homeland, and the fourth is to live there as an individual. Now, even Ramban admits there are reasons why one would not have to make aliyah, but they have to be specific reasons. Ramban basically says, well, one reason why you're exempt from aliyah is you're allowed to leave the land of Israel in order to find a marriage partner. That's a classical heter, man or woman. The other reason why you could leave the land of Israel, although it wouldn't be that common today, is you can leave Eretz Yisrael to go to Chutz La'aretz if you need to study Torah. Meaning...
What?
Well, again, today it almost doesn't make sense, yeah. But there were times when Israel was so desolate that there weren't yeshivot, there weren't Torah teachers, so you could go. And the third is one can leave Eretz Yisrael or not make Aliyah if one is unable to make a parnasah, if one cannot make a living. But that's the big one. That's the tricky one. What do we mean by making a living? Certainly, if by moving to Israel you are going to live in poverty, that would be an exemption. On the other hand, inherently there's going to be a reduction, usually, in the level of affluence that one has. And one could not simply say that just because there'll be a reduction, that itself would absolve one of the obligations. Then nobody would ever have to go. I mean, there's nobody... Well, I won't say nobody. Actually, I know one person who's actually doing better in Israel than in the United States. But by and large, that is a very, very rare situation. Well, you know, in Israel, you know, in America, you have a rabbi of a shul or something. In Israel, you have the rabbi of the floor of the apartment building. You know, he's the rabbi of the fourth floor. You know, so he has, you know, so a rabbi does. But you know, the truth of the matter is, depending where, in a city like Jerusalem, there really is no position as synagogue rabbi. There are 2,000 shuls probably, but there's no concept of a rabbi because shuls in Israel are very different. You know, you just wherever you happen to be in the middle of the day, so you go into the shul. You know, there aren't regular members, there aren't regular activities that shuls do that much. Shuls are not a focal point of Jewish identity in the same level. So the position of synagogue rabbi is almost non-existent in Yerushalayim, let's say. On the other hand, certainly there are rabbis who teach in yeshivot and the like, but even then, yeah, you know, there's so many yeshivot and so many rabbis, it's hard to get a position. Yeah.
What would the interpretation be if children are in Israel that are only making it because parents are having their retirement age, etc., and they can't do that anymore?
So the question is whether the kids should come back to Chutz Laretz. Well, once again, if they don't have a source of income, they can go back. But I should say, too, that the commentaries tell us that according to Ramban, because living in the land of Israel is such an important mitzvah, it overrides the mitzvah of honoring parents. So, for example, if a couple wants to make, a couple or a single person wants to make aliyah, and the parents say no, now, according to halacha, the children, I'm talking about adult children, the children have the right not to obey their parents, because just as if a parent were to tell a child to desecrate Shabbat, it's crystal clear, there, it's actually absolutely clear, that kibud av ve'em does not override other mitzvot, because as the Talmud says, God says to me, you and your parents have to listen to my law, so your parents don't have the right to tell you to override God's law. That even applies to something like living in the land of Israel. Like Ramban. Again, keep in mind, I'm only talking about one half of an equation here. I'm going to talk about the other half in a moment. Yeah.
But suppose, to take this woman's analogy
a little
further, it means impoverishing elderly parents. Does that fall under the roof of honoring
and not honoring? Now, when you say impoverishing, it's forcing your... Let me make it very clear. If my kids want to move to Israel, they can do so over my objection. But I have no duty to support them over my objection. No, that's crystal clear. I mean, in other words, they can do what they want, but I don't have to pay for it. No, that's very clear. That's very clear. Same thing with yeshivot, by the way. As you should know that if an adult child, an adult, of course, means 13, right? 12, decides that a certain yeshiva is better for them, for their Torah study, than another yeshiva, they have the right to go to the yeshiva that they feel is better for them, even if it's over their parents' wishes. But the parents certainly don't have to pay. You don't have to pay for something that you think is not good for your child, right? So, de facto, therefore, parents do have the power of the purse string, which is a very, very powerful image. And the third one, by the way, is shiduchim, marriage, for the same reason that everyone tries to get their parents' blessing to their marriage. But according to halacha, parents do not have a veto. I mean, I'm not talking about an intermarriage. If I want to marry a Jewish woman, my parents don't like her. Parents do not have a veto over a choice of mate, because that has to be a person's. Now, but again, I want to emphasize, that doesn't mean one ignores their parental input. I mean, parents may have wisdom, experience. Certainly, you take it into account, but there's no veto. There's a, to paraphrase Mordechai Kaplan's reference to halacha, which I do not agree with, parents have a voice and not a veto. He said it about halacha, and of course. I would not agree to that statement on halacha, but it does accurately describe the parental role in shiduchim. Yeah.
It, the last pasuk of 15
yeah.
talks about the oath of Avram. Right.
Uh-huh.
Or at least anyway in the it says here in my commentary.
Right.
But when David went to conquer Yerushalayim, he no longer felt bound by the oath. Why would there have been...
Right, I'll discuss that. Well, the reason is because the oath was made, just get ahead of myself a little bit, the oath was made to Avimelech, his son, and his grandson. And according to tradition, the grandson of Avimelech survived for hundreds of years. but by the time of David, the last surviving grandson of Avimelech died, and therefore that covenant was no longer in effect. That's how Chazal learned. Now, so anyway, so we have these four components of Yishuv Eretz Yisrael, right? Conquest, making it inhabitable and productive.
Making others go there.
Creating, regarding it as a national home, and living there as an individual, unless you have a special dispensation. Now, in truth, Nachmanides himself did come to the land of Israel, but he went there under very unusual circumstances. He was the greatest rabbinic leader in Spain, and as was the custom in those days, he was involved in public disputations regarding Judaism versus Christianity, and he debated an apostate Jewish man who had become a friar, Dominican friar, and they debated the Talmud and about Jesus and everything else. And we even have a record of Nachmanides' disputation. It's been translated in English as well. It's called the Disputation at Barcelona. And what happened here was good news and bad news. The good news was that he was judged the winner of the debate. The bad news was that because he discredited the Catholic faith, he was ordered banished from Spain. But of course, that bad news actually became good news. So he was banished from Spain. He made his way to the land of Israel through a very, very perilous voyage. And he arrived in Israel. He arrived in Yerushalayim. And he wrote, we have some letters that he wrote from Eretz Israel. He wrote his famous commentary on the Torah in the land of Israel. And in fact, he even incorporates various archaeological finds. For example, what is a shekel? What is a half shekel? He said, well, I actually found one. Etc. And he writes in that letter, and it's amazing, when he came, basically there were almost no Jews. There was not a minion of Jews at Jerusalem. There was not a Sefer Torah in the city. To make a minyan for Rosh Hashanah, they had to get like a few Jews from Hebron and a Sefer Torah from somewhere else, and they patched together. And as you know, the oldest Beit HaKnesset in Yerushalayim is called the Beit HaKnesset of the Ramban. It's still a functional... It's in Yerushalayim, in the Old City. It's still a synagogue in the Old City. Of course, it's been renovated and rebuilt a lot. But on that site was, and the Ramban was considered
the
to be...
It's
next to the Churva. It's called Beis HaKnesset Shel Ramban, yeah. It's under. The Churva is on top, and this is under. I mean, it's still used. It is a regular synagogue. But it is the oldest, other than the Temple Mount itself, is the oldest continuously in use synagogue, except for the 48 to 67. It was obviously not in use then. And so one of the questions one might ask is, well, gee, wait a second here. Ramban himself is the one that says, you got to live in Israel. So now, the only reason he wound up in Israel was because he got kicked out of Spain. Why is the Ramban not following his own halachic advice? And the answer has to be, number one, that we cannot even imagine the physical dangers of such a journey. You know, you may remember when we studied Kuzari, some of you. You remember Yehuda Halevi, who was before the Ramban, also eventually made his way to the land of Israel, and according to tradition, it might be apocryphal, he was on his knees in front of the walls of Jerusalem when an Arab came by and stabbed him, and he died at the gates of entering the city. So the amount of danger of the trip, and once you were there, and the really inability to make a parnasa, what could you do there, really would have exempted you from the commandments, even under Nachmanides' analysis. But nevertheless, Nachmanides does, of course, basically say that we have a mitzvah, even today, of living in the land of Israel, and a mitzvah of even military conquest of all land within the territorial boundaries of Eretz Israel.
Actually, when he was living, the notion of capturing
That's correct. There was no possibility at that point. That's right. The question becomes, so how do you take what he said then, and what does it mean today? Yeah.
I don't agree with it, because I know my Jewish history. There were pogroms. There were everything you could think of.
Yeah.
Why didn't they come to Israel? Why were we successful in 1948? Or before 48? My parents came when it was desolated, nothing else. I'm really so in awe for my grandfather who left a beautiful Poland and business and everything else, and it came to nothing.
Well,
if everybody else did it, then you have
I was reading Golda Meir's autobiography, and you know, she talked about the what happened to Israel in 1917. You know, we complain, you know, if whatever it is, we don't have air conditioning in our apartment. I mean, you know, that it was very, very different, very, very hard. Yeah, it's very true.
Yeah, they came and it stood.
But the point is, you still can't compare. In other words, you cannot compare 1870, 1880 with 1200. I can tell you that it was just very, very different. I mean, there was nothing.
In Spain during this time, there was a lot of anti-Jewish activity. There were riots for certain groups of Arabs and the horrible pogroms that they occurred.
Yeah, well,
is, would that have been a reason for someone like Nachmanides, who was a leader of the community?
That's very possible. Keep in mind that in Nachmanides' time, as opposed to Maimonides, which was a little earlier, Spain was under Catholic rule already. So the Islamic populations were not dominant in Spain at the time. But you're correct that certainly a cheshbon, some people call it a cop-out on the part of rabbis, but there's certainly a cheshbon that rabbis commonly assert, and maybe we exaggerate our importance, in which we say, we gotta stay because of the people who need us. Now, the counter-argument is that if Aliyah is considered to be a value, a Jewish value, if rabbis were to take the initiative in Aliyah, that would encourage many Americans or others to make that step as well. Just for example, if you take Rabbi Riskin, who was a very prominent American rabbi who built up a large, large congregation in New York, and that congregation is still flourishing, Lincoln Square Synagogue, and he kind of just took up, and he took a number of his members and other people who went with him. So the question becomes, is that a model that we would espouse? Now, realistically speaking, just looking at the realities, obviously a majority of the Jewish population of the United States and really other Western countries are never, until Mashiach comes to this, are never going to move out. So there will always be a significant diaspora community. And then at least a rabbi or a spiritual leader does have to make the calculation that, well, maybe I'm needed where I am. But it's a hard question. And the point is that, again, I'm not talking about this now. I live here too. I mean, the point is not for me to say everybody has to make Aliyah tomorrow, but I just want to bring out that in Halachic Judaism, the issue of Aliyah might be much more significant than people think it is. People tend to look at it as, you know, they don't think about it at all. You know, they think about it, but it's not regarded as any type of halakha that needs to be considered. In point of fact, according to Ramban, it does fall within halakhic categories. Now, let me just sketch the other side of the coin, because there obviously has to be another side of the coin here. The other side of the coin is Maimonides. Now, Maimonides is, I fret, that's much too harsh of a word, but Maimonides seems to be of two minds about this issue. On one hand, Maimonides writes very, very frequently about the spiritual holiness of the land of Israel. He writes about how it's God's special land and there are many, many blessings. But he shies away from describing it as a mitzvah. He does not consider it to be a halachically binding obligation to live in the land of Israel. Of course, what's very interesting is, if you know Maimonides' biography, you know that he actually did live in the land of Israel as a child before Bar Mitzvah. He was born in Egypt. I'm sorry, he was born in Spain. I'm sorry, he was born in Spain. And at a time when he was born, Spain was under Islamic persecution. And because of the various Islamic persecutions, his parents migrated to Morocco. And then they migrated to the land of Israel, and they stayed for less than 1 year. And then they went back to Morocco and eventually to Egypt, and Maimonides spent the bulk of his life in Egypt. But he did spend around the year before his bar mitzvah in the land of Israel, and he writes that the day that he saw the Western Wall, what was the Western Wall then, by the way? It wasn't as big as today. It was primarily a garbage heap, so a little bit of wall was showing above a huge dung heap. He said he treated that day as a holiday the rest of his life, the anniversary of the day that he saw the Kotel was a personal Yom Tov for him. He made a party every day of his life. So he had a tremendous yearning for the land of Israel, and paradoxically, he was relatively near to it. He was in Egypt, but he never again went back to Eretz Israel. Of course, he was in the royal service. He was the physician of the Sultan in Cairo. And when he died, as you know, Maimonides is buried in the land of Israel, and he's buried in somewhat of an unusual place. He died in Egypt, so there's one would have assumed that Yerushalayim or Hebron is much closer, but he's buried all the way north in Tiberia. And the story goes, and again, I don't know if this is true, the story goes that just like when the Philistines took the ark and they captured the ark, we'll read in the book of Samuel, and the ark brought all sorts of calamities on the Philistines, so they finally said, let's get rid of this thing. They put the ark on a wagon with a bunch of cows leading it, and the cows take it right to the right place. So the story goes that when Maimonides' body was being brought to the land of Israel, all the cities of Israel were vying for the right, were vying for the right to bury him. And so they just put the coffin on a wagon with the cows or whatever it is, and they figure wherever the cows stop is God's will. And apparently those cows kept on walking and walking and walking until they reached all the way to Tiberia. And that is why he's buried by the Yam Kinneret in Tiberia, next to Rabbi Akiva's grave, and Rav Moshe Chaim Lutzato, a few other people that are buried in that cemetery. Maimonides complained about his job a lot. Maimonides complained he was working too hard as a doctor. Maimonides originally was supported by his brother, who was a jewel merchant. And Maimonides spent his whole time studying and learning and teaching Torah. His brother died at sea. And then Maimonides had to get a job. His brother drowned at sea. Maimonides had to get a job. He became a physician. But he complained, and to think about it, he described his schedule, that basically, I don't know how much work he had to do there, but apparently he describes it as morning to night, seeing the Sultan's harem and the families, and everyone always had some complaint about something, and he didn't get home till 2 hours after sunset, let's say 8 o'clock at night, and when he got home, there'd be lines of Jewish people. Some people came for medical advice, some people came for halachic advice, and he would have to say he hadn't eaten anything. He had no way of eating anything there for some reason. So he said he had to eat supper for 10 minutes. And then he would see people lying down on a couch, kind of reverse Freudian. He would lie on the couch and treat people. And then that would go on for 2 hours. And then he would not do any of his own Torah writing till after 10 o'clock at night. So all of his works, The Guide to the Perplexed, the Mishnah Torah, were produced on that part-time, very part-time basis. So just phenomenal if you consider the schedule.
When did he write the
Guide to the Perplexed?
Yeah,
The Guide to the Perplexed he wrote in his 50s.
Before?
Yeah, the Guide to the Perplexed was written before the Mishnah Torah. The Mishnah Torah was his last major work. The Guide to the Perplexed, as you know, was written in Arabic. The Mishnah Torah was written
Who translated it?
The Ibn Tibbon family. I mean, they were the ones who translated all the Arabic works into Hebrew. Yeah.
Were the mitzvot, 613 mitzvot, up for grabs? That one man can say this is it, and
well, again, you know, I'm oversimplifying things. Oh. I mean, obviously, all of these judgments depend on examining the entire Talmud, the Midrash, and trying to extract: is it a mitzvah? Is it not a mitzvah? I mean, there's a whole literature as to why. But let me share with you one Gemara, which is often adduced in support of Maimonides, that there is no commandments to either conquer. Because remember, if you negate the commandment, you're not only negating the mitzvah of living, you're also negating the mitzvah of conquer. You're doing that, the force. In other words, you're negating all four steps. And the proof is a very interesting Gemara in Masechet Ketubot, which is often cited by anti-Zionists as delegitimizing a Jewish state before the coming of Mashiach. And it's based on a verse in the Song of Songs, a very enigmatic verse that appears three times. And the verse says, Hishpati etchem benot Yerushalayim, I impose an oath on you, I adjure you, daughters of Jerusalem. This is repeated three times in the Song of Songs, im ta'iru v'im ta'oreru, that you don't stir up, nor should you awaken et ha'ahava, God's love for his people, ad shetechpatz, until it desires to reveal itself. It's a very enigmatic verse. Even if you're learning the Song of Songs, it's not entirely clear what that verse means to say. But the Talmud offers the following interpretation. And remember, it's repeated three times. It says that when God destroyed the first temple and sent the Jews into Galut, he made them swear three oaths. Now this doesn't mean, you know, somebody actually swore, but it means God imposed three oaths on the Jewish people. Oath number one, Lo Ya'alu Bachoma, they shall not climb the wall. What does that mean? Rashi says, they shall not try to conquer the land of Israel by force of arms. This was said to be a shvurah. Oath number two, they will not rebel against their host countries. They will be faithful citizens of the land that they live in. And oath number three, they will not try to force the coming of the Mashiach before the right time. Apparently this refers to various magical Kabbalistic incantations that could hasten the redemption. And there is a concept that just like a baby that is born too prematurely will often not be able to survive, there's a certain catastrophic element in precipitating the redemptive process before its natural fruition and development. Essentially, what do these three oaths say? This is from the Talmud. The three oaths indicate what you might regard as a stance of quiescence in the face of Galut, meaning to say that you're put into Galut, don't rebel against your host nations, don't try to conquer anything, don't try to push Mashiach, be patient, endure, don't challenge, and just wait, wait, wait. Now you understand, this is exactly the primary Talmudic text that Satmir Neturei Karta look to say we don't have a right to establish a state. And obviously, this would be in support of Maimonides. Now, not that you can't have a state, but certainly it supports Maimonides' argument that there's no commandment to conquer, because we're told not to conquer. Right? If there'd be a commandment, we couldn't be told not to. Now, I should say, though, that the vast majority of halakhically observant Jews don't accept that argument. So what do they do with the text? So it's interesting that there are two answers that are given classically why that text does not preclude the Zionist endeavor. One argument is that if you go on in the Gemara, there is a fourth oath that is mentioned. And the fourth oath is what God made the nations of the world swear, and that is that they will not oppress the Jewish people excessively and unreasonably. So the trade-off is, we sit tight in Galut and don't complain, assuming we're treated with a measure of decency. Now, since it is obvious that the Umot HaOlam, in the course of Jewish history, have not comported with that obligation, whether it be the Inquisition, or the Crusades, or the pogroms, or the Holocaust, then we ourselves are released from that notion of having to stay in Galut. That's one position. The other position is that the state of Israel was not created by an act of conquest. The state of Israel was created legally by international agreement and by UN resolution, and whatever wars were fought were wars of defense to prevent an internationally recognized structure from being vanquished. So even if it's true that the Talmudic oath precludes conquest, as it were, to establish a state, it does not preclude defense of a state that was established either by international recognition or that was recognized by the Balfour Declaration. Of course, the Balfour Declaration is ambiguous to this very day, and I imagine it was deliberately ambiguous. Her Majesty's government, His Majesty's government recognizes with favor the establishment of a Jewish homeland, and something about, I don't remember the exact words, without prejudice to the Arabs that live there. Many have argued that the veiled implication of the Balfour Declaration was not that there would be a Jewish state, but simply Jews should have the right to immigrate, but it should not be to the prejudice of any Arab government that wants to be established. Some argued that the Balfour Declaration was not a legitimation of statehood, it was a legitimation of immigration. Of course, the British didn't. No, it doesn't say. See, the Balfour Declaration, I don't think, maybe I'm wrong, I don't think it uses the word statehood. I think it uses the word homeland.
Yeah, homeland.
And Reagan. Some have said homeland specifically does not mean to include state.
Regev just wrote a book on
the Yehudi.
Of a man named Regev, an Israeli.
Right.
All about that.
That's British, right. That's right. Yeah, of course, the British record in Palestine, as it was called, was notorious, and to this day, there are many Israelis that cannot. They look at the British as the Germans. I mean, really, it's just very, very awful. Yeah.
Well, isn't there a distinction
between Jew and
Israel, just
a slave,
as opposed to
coming in the chair? Yeah, but the Satmar, who takes the interpretation of the Talmud fairly literally, basically says that God is basically saying that until Mashiach comes, you can't establish even a state. That's the first oath. The third oath is don't push Mashiach. The first one is don't conquer by force of arms. Now, I just want to say one thing. Now, if you think about this, this obviously does have religious implications for territorial concession and the like. Meaning, if you take Ramban's view, that there's actually a divine mitzvah that every inch of the land of Israel should be conquered and brought under Jewish domination, not only would we be reluctant to give up something, he would actually call on some level for a war of aggression to conquer territory. If, on the other hand, one takes Maimonides' position that there's no mitzvah to conquer today, and certainly if you take the Satmar position, which is that it's forbidden, but even if you don't go that far, but there's no mitzvah, then obviously the primary consideration would not be land. The primary consideration would be not endangering the lives and security of people. And therefore, halakha would at least permit the various territorial concessions that would maximize the security of a population. Of course, that doesn't mean you should give away things, because actually giving away things may endanger, but at least halakha would permit and encourage the calculus of what types of arrangements maximize security. In other words, you could approach the peace process in two ways. You know, you could say, as a fundamentalist, you could say, we are not allowed to give back a single inch. Or you could say, our main concern is what will protect our populations. So the question is, Ramban would seem to emphasize the sanctity of not giving up the land, where Maimonides emphasize the concept of trying to protect your populations. Now the irony is, you may come out on the same side with either of those arguments, because many, as we see now, some of the concessions may in fact endanger populations. But whatever it is, none of us have perfect hindsight, or perfect foresight. We have perfect hindsight, not perfect foresight. But the point is that, at least according to Maimonides, there is a basis for territorial concession as part of an overall attempt to achieve security for the state of Israel. Like Nachmanides, that might be less legitimate. That's why I say, if American Jews live here, they have obviously opted to follow Maimonides' view of their personal life. So for an American Jew who lives here and follows Maimonides' view, to articulate a theological stance that not a single inch of the land of Israel could be given back is essentially hypocritical, because they are imposing the view of Nachmanides when they are not willing to live by that standard in their own personal life. But again, if one argues, however, that one is against the Oslo process because of the endangerment to human life, that is a legitimate argument. And unfortunately, I think we see that is more of a legitimate argument than many people thought. Yeah.
If if the first three shvuot
right.
came from Shir HaShirim,
right.
the verse that's repeated three times,
yeah,
where does the fourth one come
yeah,
from?
Yeah, I'm going to have to look. In other words, the Gemara unearths another verse that creates a reciprocity. I can find it for you. It's Tubot, page 111, Kuf Yud Aleph. You can actually see that. But again, that three shvuot is very fundamental. I mean, that is really the... I mean, there are other sources, but that is the primary source text for the anti-Zionist school of thought. And but you see, it's based on an underlying philosophy. The underlying philosophy is, which in a way is inconsistent with Judaism in other areas, is, well, God put you in galut, and therefore it's up to you to grin and bear it until such time as God redeems you. I mean, that's the theory. The problem with that theory is that's inconsistent with Jewish values in many other areas. For example, we seek medical intervention. Now, Christian scientists make the argument that if a person gets sick, it was the will of God that they be ill. God made you sick. So it's wrong for you as a human being to try to use human or natural means to alleviate illness, and the only way you can alleviate illness is by prayer. This is the Christian science position, with some nuances. You know, we have liberal Christian scientists who say, well, if you broke your leg, that's a man-made thing, and they make that differentiation. But, you know, there have been cases in American law where Christian science parents, their children have died for not getting medical treatment, and the parents have been prosecuted. I mean, they're good parents, they're not abusive parents, but their religious belief is that you can't seek medical intervention, just like the witnesses believe you can't have a blood transfusion. And sometimes their kids are forcibly taken to be given blood transfusion.
Now, insulin neither.
Yeah, that's right. Now, Judaism rejects that, right? Judaism basically says that if there's suffering, we are bidden to try to alleviate that suffering by natural means. Mm-hmm. And we don't simply say, God put us in and God takes us out. So it seems, just on a very broad level, that the philosophy that galut is God's punishment and therefore we're not allowed to take steps to improve our situation seems to contradict the normal approach, unless they're somehow differentiated between national responses and individual responses, meaning the individual takes the steps, but nationally we have to await. But as I say, that is a minority position. Yeah.
But the Satima, I know it sounds funny to say defend them, their non-Zionist view is based also on halacha. When it
That's
became
right.
a nation, they didn't want Jews to run it on Shabbos.
No, but that's
assembly,
I want to emphasize that the Satmar opposition to the State of Israel is not only because it's operated in a non-halachic way.
But it is one of them.
That makes it worse, so to speak. But there
Why
again,
worse?
Because non-halachic. In other words, making it non-halachic makes it worse, but that's not the essence of the problem. The essence of the problem is that even if the state would be operated by Rosh Yeshivot and great rabbis, they feel it is halachically wrong to establish a state until the coming of the Mashiach. See, that's a different issue. In other words, the issue of the religious or non-religious character of the state is a secondary, serious problem, but primarily they're focusing it on the state. And as a result, you see very bizarre things where, you know, occasionally there were satmirs that would actually run an ad supporting a Palestinian state. You know, it's a little bizarre because...
they wanted to be...
Like some of them are ministers. For a while, one of the ministers before there was the Palestinian Authority, when Arafat, whatever he was, government in exile or whatever it was called, one of his ministers was actually a minister of propaganda. Was a satmar or something. So it was kind of a very very bizarre situation. Okay, so I just wanted to bring this out in terms of the perspective of this mitzvah of kibush. That there is at least one authority, one very eminent authority, Nachmanides, that asserts that the commandments of kibush are operative even today. Not just defense, but even actual conquest of territory within the boundaries of the State of Israel. And that's why, basically, the issue of lands for peace and everything else, with halakha, but I just want to leave the bottom line that according to Maimonides, there is a flexibility in being able to deal with the matter from the standpoint of security. Yeah.
Yeah, I have a problem with the terminology of having the res and vetra being that the state is created by international agreement.
Yes.
Because you go down that route, it's dependent on this international agreement for what is going to be your right. completely, that could jeopardize the right.
I mean, what they give you, they could take away.
That's
meaning you don't want to predicate your right to establish a state on the Umota Olam giving you permission to do so. Yeah, obviously, we want to have our claim based on God. Yeah, I think it's a good question. It may indicate perhaps there is a tenuous basis before the coming of Mashiach for a state. And I want to say another thing too. You know, you often hear this idea that we have some eternal promise that there will always be a state of Israel. One has to say that although we hope and we pray that, God forbid, nothing should ever happen. As far as I could see, there is no particular divine promise that there will be a state. What you see from Tanakh is that there will only be two exiles, meaning there was the Babylonian exile that ended with the Second Temple, building of the Second Temple, and then there's the present exile that occurred upon the destruction of the Second Temple. And once we are redeemed from that second exile, there will never be another exile. But the problem is, we have not yet been redeemed from that second exile. We are still in a stage of galut in various severities. And consequently, because the second galut has not yet ended, anything could happen in the course of that second galut until the coming of Mashiach. Therefore, there is the theoretical, and again, we hope and we pray that it should never happen, but there is absolutely no particular guarantee that Medinat Yisrael, as a matter of a spiritual entity, would have to inevitably survive, simply because we're not out of that second galut yet, and therefore the promise...
Why aren't we out of the galut?
Well, there's no Beit HaMikdash yet, and that's a part of...
thank God we don't have Kavanah.
Well, okay, that's a whole issue, but nevertheless, we do talk about the restoration of the Beit HaMikdash in our prayers. So the question is, could Judaism survive without a state of Israel? A very, very scary and frightening question. But we do know that the answer is yes, because the proof of the pudding is that we have. So, again, no one can be a prophet, but part of what I think God is asking us to consider here is to remember that nothing in this life, nothing in this life is a sure bet, and therefore God is saying that it's important for us to mend our own fences, to build unity, to try to intensify our commitment to mitzvot, to increase our love for each other, because God is saying that without those things, don't think, you know, there's anything in the world that is guaranteed to you. This can slip away, and that can slip away, and that can slip away, and you know, it kind of is a very, very sobering lesson in terms of our need to try to make ourselves worthy of the opportunities and the gifts that Hashem gives us. That is correct. That is correct. Just read the Torah. That's what happened. That's how galut happens. But the point is, I'm saying we're not out of the second galut yet. Therefore, there's no promise of eternal redemption at this point in time. So this is something to think about. So on one hand, the connection of the Jewish people to Israel is an eternal bond that does not depend on our good deeds, but as you say, our right to live in it is very much conditional. Meaning we never lose it, but we might lose our occupancy of it. It's always our land, but things could happen. So these are very, very sobering times that one has to very much think about what's going on. And there's an old tradition that Chazal articulate in many, many contexts, that the enemy that destroys us from the outside is a reflection of an enemy that is within us, that destroys us from within, and that would be, you know, our own sinat chinam, our own dissension, polarization, etc. Right, right. Those who destroy you come out of you.
They come
from yourself.
That's what we have right now in Israel.
Well, yeah, I don't want to say just in Israel. I want to say there. Yeah, I mean, this is what we have. I mean, what we have is what we all have, and you know, and that's an issue. By the way, you know, there are a lot of various tours that are being organized to show support for Israel. You can get a very good price right now for hotels and planes. And I know that some people who were in Israel say that they're approached by Israelis constantly, thanking them for coming and showing their solidarity at that point. So might be something to consider if one has any time. Yeah.
You know, I think if we're not able to go on a mission to go to Israel, we should all call people in Israel and let them know we're victims.
Right. Yeah.
There's a lot of schools.
During the Second World War, when the Jews to open doors in America to Israel, to the Jews in Europe, Roosevelt took a lot of signal from the leadership of the Jewish people, or the so-called leadership, which at that time the Orthodox had very little influence, but were more led by Stephen Wise.
Yes.
Who were against letting the Jews in. They were against the letting the Jews in, and as a result, Roosevelt did very little to almost the end of the war when Martin fell. Finally, spoke to people from the Baha'i Fallen Pressure.
Right.
The Orthodox didn't have the clout in those days. But the same group that was so important, led by Stephen Wise, makes me think of the same group that had been pressuring Israel to give in. I mean, it's hard to understand why did Stephen Wise, why did those reforms not want the Jewish people to stay in those days? And why would there some people in America not want Israel to be strong in these days? They pressure the land for peace without the other side of the country, which is security with the land, security. But it seems to be the same type of thing of our case, which is, if we are defeated, if our leaders are defeated, we show the world that we don't care enough. So the Jews weren't, when there wasn't enough pressure, the Jews, unfortunately, had to live in the Europe and they killed them.
Well, the Jews don't care enough. Why should the political leaders put themselves out to be more aggressive in protecting Israel than the Jewish leaders call for?
Because a lot of it is with us.
I don't say it's the same type of sentiment. I think it's even like the issue was they didn't want to, it's almost like the German Jews looking at the Polish Jews that they looked down on them. Like they didn't want the immigrants. Whereas what's going on in Israel today, I think people are looking towards like the rights of the different people's rights.
Well, there's other things too. What I'm saying is, even what was the plan that billions may die?
Well, there are kinds of, there are a few things,
They do know about it.
I just want to say that Stephen Wise in particular, again, he was, number one, he was a super patriot. And, when there were various proposals, in Hungary in particular, that for trucks and everything else and for money they would release various Jews, Stephen Wise felt, and in retrospect it was wrong, he felt that if you supply the Germans with trucks and with money, that will prolong the war, and ultimately that could hurt more people. So he felt you cannot prolong the war even if that's at the expense of Jews dying. I mean, this was his calculation. He did not want to prolong the war by providing aid and support to the enemy. This was his cheshbon. Now, I don't think it was because he was a Reform rabbi in particular. This was his particular calculus. The Orthodox activists primarily recognized, as Halacha says they should, the primacy of saving all lives that you can save, well, even if it means giving stuff to the Nazis, to the German army. But that was the problem. And, he was a super patriot. He really was. Many people said that many Americans regarded Roosevelt as God, or as Moses at least. And he was their great, great hero.
Some people didn't know.
He lost the job over that issue.
Your father spoke out against Roosevelt.
I'm sorry, but what I meant was most people didn't know.
They knew, but they suppressed it. They didn't want it.
Well, they figured he must know what's best for people.
Telegrams that people got through and they did know. But the environment was such, like this, what's his name?
perform one that one.
Why Stephen Weiss? Yeah.
Did you ever hear him speak? I saw a tape. He spoke such flowery English.
Well, he was called the Jewish Pope. He was extremely, the leading rabbi in the United States.
There's another reform rabbi here in Washington.
Who
was very influential.
Silva?
They were like, they had a lot of influence over Russell, where the Orthodox had no clout. Similar to Dave, he was now generating a lot more noise.
I just want to say, the reform movement did come to Zionism fairly late, although now they embrace
it.
The truth is, I want to say, though, that there was not just the Tu'ei Karta, but if you even go back to German Orthodoxy in general, Rav Shimshon Ophel Hirsch was also, of course, he was in the late 19th century, he was against the idea of a Jewish state. He actually quoted the same text that the Satmar quoted, that until the Galut is over, and of course he had great belief in the Enlightenment and the progress of man and everything else, but he also was against it. When he was solicited to encourage Aliyah, the first wave of Aliyah, he basically said, he didn't consider it the right time. He said that, we're not, we're still in the Galut, and we should not talk about establishing separate nationalities. So the notion of Jewish nationalism as not being a proper goal was actually held by a number of eminent, even Orthodox rabbis.
That's probably why a lot of them that could have gotten out of Europe probably didn't
want to
go there.
Well, that's part of it, of course, by then, in fact, I came across a wonderful book translated in English. It's called Eim HaBanim Semecha, and this was written by a Rabbi Teichdal, who was a Hungarian Satmar, or Munkacs, which is even more extreme, anti-Zionist. And he's called the Hungarian Rav Kook, because as he is trapped in Nazi-occupied Hungary, he reevaluated his whole philosophical position, and he wrote a book, one of the last Jewish books published in Nazi-occupied Europe, 1944, in which he articulates a philosophy of the need to love all Jews and reach out to them, and the need to settle in the land of Israel. And of course, he never made it. He died. But he writes that, many of his anti-Zionist colleagues now regret their stance when it was too late to leave.
Aim
HaBanim Smecha.
But I think what you said is a misrepresentation of the Israeli today, because I'm the regional director of our that the rabbis are very, very concerned about the security of Israel, and of course that they want peace. That's their prime motive, and they care about all people, but most of all they care about the security of Israel. And there's an active movement in the synagogues to get people to speak out about the bias in the media and support Israel and its security. So I don't think it's quite issues that.
Well, I wanted to say,
I didn't say reform movement. I said our leaders.
And no, I'm talking about the leaders in the reform movement.
I did try to say that Rabbi Gerstenfeld and Rabbi Whitehead did not represent the vast majority of people on the street, but they were the leaders known to Roosevelt. Michael Lerner has the idea of Hillary Clinton and not the reformed man. In terms of peace, not
security. I don't want to, given the fact that, people here are of different affiliations, I did not want to pitch this discussion on reform versus Orthodox. That was not the goal. And the fact that Stephen Weiss was reform is incidental to this discussion. I just wanted to point out that there were those, and I'll say it wasn't good faith. I don't want to accuse him of bad faith, who mistakenly believed that giving that type of aid to the enemy would be wrong, even if it could save thousands of lives. And that was a very, very unfortunate mistake, and he was the one that did have Roosevelt's ear. He was the most powerful, influential rabbi in the United States.
By the way, I saw this today, in 1942, there was a protest by some Orthodox rabbis, and they did go to Washington. In fact, my father was one of them, and he never believed in that.
Right.
And they weren't seen by Roosevelt.
They were not seen, that's correct.
Because Stephen Weiss said, don't meet with the rebels.
Right.
These things are written up. They looked at the calendar. Roosevelt had time that day.
Right. Okay. Well, obviously the feelings are strong because these are very emotional issues.
Why won't these in parentheses, the cities?
No, that means because they're written a certain way, but they should be read another way. There are many words in Tanakh. Kri and Kasif.
Okay.
Yeah, now, actually, that's just, that's just the perspective on this issue of conquest and the various opinions, Rambam and Ramban. Well, here's the problem. There are those that held that view had there not been a state of Israel. There are those who feel it would have been better had it not been established. But once it's established, there's no one besides them that are calling for dismantling or something like that. So that you're not going to find anymore. But there were many. There were those who were really not in favor of establishing a state at that time. As you know, it's still a matter of controversy to this very day. On Yom HaTzmaut, which is Israeli Independence Day, the 5th of Iyar, do you celebrate it by the recitation of Hallel or not? And you know, this is a controversy of which sometimes there are fist fights, even to this very day, over that. The prayer for the State of Israel. Actually, it's very, very fascinating. There are two groups of Jews now who do not recite the prayer for the State of Israel. And they're opposite sides of the coin. One is the Satmar side that says there shouldn't be a State of Israel. And the other that regards the government as so traitorous in giving up land that you shouldn't pray for their welfare at all. So you have kind of extreme Zionists on the one side and extreme anti-Zionists on the other side. And they both say, we're not going to pray for this government of the state of Israel. So politics makes strange bedfellows when it comes to this. Okay. Now, this brings us to the second half of the book. And the second half of the book, as I say, deals not with kibbush, but it deals with chiluk. And I think, just to go over briefly, the word goral is used over and over again. And the word goral is lottery, drawing lots. Just like we say the word Purim, it says, he peel pur, which is a Persian word. Haman did a pur, which is a goral. In other words, when he was looking for the right month to kill the Jews, he believed in the goral, so he came out with the month of Adar, right? So Purim means lots, and goral means lots. Now, the issue I think of how on earth does a lottery work? Now, obviously, the assumption is that lotteries were not regarded as games of chance, so to speak, but they were regarded as having some divine imprimatur and divine inspiration. And that's why, you know, if the lottery, what do you have? You have two boxes. One box has the tribes in it, and one box has the shtachim, the areas of land in it, and you pick a slip and another slip, Yehuda gets matched up with his place. Obviously, this was thought to be a divine inspiration, and therefore was given a certain value. We find, of course, in other places that a lottery is sometimes considered to be motivated by Ruach HaKodesh. We, of course, have it in the book of Yonah, when the storm is destroying the boat, and they want to find out who's responsible, so they draw a lottery, and then it turns out to be Yonah. And of course, the sailors are very nice, right? The sailors, you figure, once they know he's the culprit, just throw him across, and they say, well, maybe we'll make it, etc., but ultimately, they throw him overboard. Now, I had mentioned, just to go over this briefly, I know I had mentioned 2 weeks ago, the problem of the lotteries, however, is a difficulty, because if we assume that the territorial pieces were of a different size, and the tribes are of a different population, how do you know that the big territory will go to the big tribe? Maybe the big slip will go to the small tribe, and the small slip will go to the big tribe. And how do you know that ahead of time? In other words, how do you draw the sizes of your pieces? First of all, right, how do you even know where to draw your pieces? So there are two basic approaches to this, and that is, approach number one is that on the territorial designations, they were simply the general geographical area. but the size was not adjusted till you knew which tribe. So in other words, you would simply say, you would divide Eretz Yisrael into southeastern, northeastern, northwestern, southwestern, and then you would match it up. So the Goral simply tells you, Yehuda gets south. Now, how large is your southern section is then a function of, once you know which tribe gets it, you draw the boundaries to encompass it. In other words, the boundaries were not determined till after the lottery, not before the lottery. The only thing the lottery matched up was the general geographical area. That is one approach to it. I think the Abarbanel says that approach. Now the Pasuk does not say that, by the way, but we have to read it. I mean, the Pasuk seems to indicate the boundaries were already there to begin with, but the Abarbanel says that is post the allocation of lottery. That's approach number one. Approach number two is Ramban's approach, which does not fit any map at all that I've ever seen. The Ramban says, well, the 12 areas were equal. The land of Israel was divided into equal pieces, and therefore every tribe got the same amount of territory, so it made no difference what slip came up. If you got the same, however, the problem with Ramban's approach is, number one, it doesn't seem to follow the configuration of cities, which indicates different territories, but number two, it does seem to introduce an inequity in the tribal division, because if a large tribe got the same amount of land as a small tribe, then per capita, a person in a large tribe had less land. So every person in a tribe was treated equally. Within a tribe, you were treated equally. That's what Ramban says. Ramban's point is that the only equality that existed was between members of a tribe, but as between tribes, there was not necessarily any equality. That's a second approach. See, the Abarbanel recognizes, as does all the maps that we've ever seen, that the big tribe got more, the small tribe got less. According to Ramban, all tribes got equal. And then there's a third approach that simply meant that we relied on the supernatural effect of the Goral, meaning we had big, small, big, small, big, small, and 12 tribes, and we just knew it would come out right, meaning to say that since the Goral was divinely inspired, because my problem is, there's almost no need for the Goral then, and you already know who's going to get what, but the Goral was a confirmation. Because according to this, the Goral was a divine confirmation of a pre-existing division that was already made. You see? So it didn't make the division, it confirmed a division. Right, so those are three approaches as to the relationship of size. Now, what makes life more complicated, and this is a point you made a few weeks ago, was that obviously dividing up land is not only a function of territory, of area, it's also a function of value, because there could be very valuable, or 1 acre of land might be much more valuable than 10 acres. So it is said in a complicated way that this chalukah was designed to ensure not only equality of area, but also equality of value, meaning to say it may very well be that some tribes got proportionally less land than other tribes, but it was compensated. It was surveyed in such a way that every tribe, except according to Ramban, every tribe got equal. According to Ramban, they didn't, but every tribe got equal value, even if proportionally there'd be less land. So it, again, you can figure out why the surveying was, see, the Goral could be done in one day, but the actual surveying and determination of value, which is hard to fix anyway, that took a very, very long, long time. Now, all of this is only one part of the chalukah, and that is the chalukah of the land among the tribes. You then have a much more detailed chalukah, and that is the allocation of land to the individuals within the tribe. And that's why it took 7 years. I mean, that took itself an extremely long, long time. But eventually the concept was that every individual, the way it worked was, every individual who was 20 years old or more, that was the cutoff point. So if I and my son came to Israel, and my son is 20 years old, I would get land and he would get land. If, however, I came with my son who was 19 years old, he would still be with me, and the only land he would ever get would be land he would inherit from me. So you have to differentiate between who is entitled to stake out their own claim and who will simply be somebody who's going to inherit from their parent eventually. Of course, the 20-year-old will also inherit, you see. The 20-year-old gets his portion and will eventually inherit from his family. But if you were less than 20, you didn't get anything. In other words, you got nothing, but you, of course, would be an heir to the parental share. That's correct. The Torah itself, now this is not in Yeshua, this is in the Torah itself, that the ability to get land was a function of your ability to defend and conquer that land, and therefore that was the age of 20. So people below the age of 20 did not get a share in the land of Israel, although eventually they would inherit the land they got from their parents. So as a result, therefore, if they weren't living at home, they would have to find a job, basically. They'd have to open a store or whatever it is. They had no particular land that they would be able to farm. Yeah.
What, if there were many sons, would they divide the piece of land?
Okay, so again, so let's figure this out. If, in other words, basically, like this, once a tribe has gotten a share, however you determine it, Barbanel or the other interpretations, we then have a survey, how many 20-year-old people are here? We divvy up the land in the number of pieces equal to the 20-year-olds. And then, of course, you have to do a lottery where they get it. And that's a survey based on value, not just area. So you divide, right? Now, if a given family has five boys and a father, and all of them are 20 years old, then that family would get six portions of land. If there are five children who are less than 20 years old, that family would only get one portion of land, which would then eventually be subdivided into smaller portions five ways. So people with older children did proportionally much better than people with younger children, because people with older children became autonomous, had autonomous rights to portions of land which were not given to people with younger children. Right? Now that...
That's right.
Because they were capable of fighting. Although, well, I'll tell you, it's a little misleading, though, because as of what age did you have to be 20? Did you have to be 20 when you entered, or you had to be 20 when it was divided? Because, you know, you could have been younger when you entered, but you did fight eventually. Now, this raises a complication regarding women. Now, the issue of women was the following. If you remember the story in the Torah, which, by the way, is mentioned in the book of Yoshua, the daughters of Tzelophehad. Now, the daughters of Tzelophehad was from the tribe of Menashe. And Tzelophehad, Yosef's son, Tzelophehad died in the desert. And if you remember the daughters, he has five daughters. And the five daughters come to Moshe, and they say, in a way, they say, our father died in the desert, but he was not one of the Korach people who rebelled against you. He died because of his own sins. Now, you'd wonder, why are they somehow bolstering the righteousness of their father by saying, he wasn't with Korach, he did something else on his own. He did his own crime. So actually, there's a rabbinic tradition that Tzelophehad has an interesting past. If you remember, there was a fellow in the desert who was gathering sticks on the day of Shabbat, and he was stoned. It doesn't say who he was, but there's a rabbinic midrash that says he was Tzelophehad. That was the sin for which he died. Now, why is that a good thing for them to bring up? So listen to what the Gemara says. The Gemara says, because the gatherer of wood actually gave his life for the sake of heaven. Why? Because this is right after the spies, right after the Jews were told they weren't going to go to Israel. And many Jews figured, if we're not going to go to Israel, we don't have to keep Shabbat anymore. So he violated Shabbat, it says, with the intention of giving up his life so that the Jews should see that you still have to keep Shabbat. So this was called a chet l'shem shamayim. A sin for this. This is a midrash. A sin for the sake of heaven. So that's why they're telling Moshe, our father is a good guy. He gave his life so that you should see that the Torah is binding. So what did they say? They say, our father had no sons. And the halakha is, normally a son inherits and not a daughter. So our father has no sons. What happens to us? So Moshe went to God. By the way, there's another midrash that says, why is Moshe not remembering? Because this is a punishment for what he said many years earlier. Many years earlier, he told, when he made subordinate judges, he said, they'll do the easy stuff, and you bring the hard stuff to me. So God thought, although Moshe was the most humble of all people, there was a certain amount of a little bit of a slip of arrogance there in saying, I'll take care of the hard things. Therefore, God says, I'll show you that there'll be some things you'll forget too. So he forgot this. And what did God tell him? God told him the general rule is that although when there are sons and daughters, again, this is a halacha, I'm not going to justify this, I'm just saying what the halacha is. The classical halacha in the Torah is when there are sons and daughters, the sons inherit and not the daughters. Of course, daughters do have to be supported by their brothers until they get married. There is a support obligation, but not an inheritance. But when there's only a daughter inherits. So what that means is the following. The five daughters of Tzlafchad came to the land of Israel. They do not get five shares of land because women who were not in the army could not claim as independent people. But they could claim as heirs of the land that would have gone to their father. And therefore, the five daughters of Tzlafchad count as one. In other words, that would be the difference. And in that way, if they would have had brothers, they would have had, well, first of all, they would have had brothers, they wouldn't have gotten anything. But in a way, five boys who show up fare better than five women who show up. Because the five women who show up claim a share based on the father that bequeaths it to them. So they get one field that they have to divide five ways. Five boys who are above 20 who show up, they get five fields. Right? So you see how the land concentration works. The woman who could not fight in the military could claim as an heir of a deceased parent, but could not claim as an original entitlement.
Right. There were restrictions placed on them.
There was a restriction because their uncles, Tzlafchad's brothers, raised the following problem. Hey, you're going to give these women a share in Menashe territory. Yeah. And what's going to happen? What if they marry a man from another tribe and they have children and those children follow the tribe of the father? Right? So what's going to happen is when she dies and her children inherit, the land of Menashe will now be owned, let's say, by children from the tribe of Yehuda. We have these Yehuda people who are living in Menashe territory. And if you recall, it was decreed that a woman who inherits property is only allowed to marry a member of the same tribe. However, it is recorded in the Gemara, although this is in the Torah itself, that this was a temporary measure that was eventually abrogated. In other words, in the long term, this was not true, which is why, over time, tribal boundaries became extremely fluid and diluted, because you did have all sorts of people there. But at least originally, for a while, we're not sure how long, there was a concept that they were not allowed to marry outside of their tribe. Yeah. Okay, I should qualify this. There is a law in the Torah that a firstborn gets a double portion, so that would have applied here. Yeah, but other than the firstborn, it is then divided equally among all sons. And again, this put a difficult position for a woman. A woman that had brothers would essentially not inherit anything in the land at all, but the counterbalancing was, number one, if she got married, she would have the benefit of her husband's estate, and number two, until she gets married, her parents, and then her brothers, have an obligation to support her in the manner to which she was accustomed. I mean, that was the basic structure of the inheritance. Okay, so that's the issue of the woman. The woman does not claim her own share, but if she is the only heir, or if the only heirs are sisters, they could claim what their father would have gotten in the desert. Okay, so that's how the chalukah worked, and there's even a mention of the debtors of Selefchad actually come into the land of Israel. I'm sorry, somebody had a hand up? Yeah.
Was there an initial attempt to use Hashem in the prophecy and a share of the value?
Well, yes. Remember, it was done on value, not on area. But, for example, well, let me give you a simple example. A father who came with 10 children below the age of 20 got no more land than a person who came with one child below the age of 20. So, in other words, the apportionment was based on people who were 20 and above. Now that, you'll see, that actually is why you'll find later that the children of Yosef complained they didn't have enough territory. Now why should that be? If the allocation was to each person that was 20, what's the problem? The answer is, Yosef had a lot of kids. That's exactly the point. We have a lot of children below 20, and therefore, by the next generation, it's going to be cut down into little tidbits. So that's exactly the thing. So, these are complicated details. A lot of it is not explained in the Bible itself, but the Talmud goes through great lengths exactly about the details of how the land was divided. Yeah, it's consolidated, although it's a little obscure. This is in Tractate Bava Batra, the eighth chapter, which is about the laws of inheritance generally. So it goes into the details regarding Chalukat Ha'aretz. But also, if you look in a commentary like the Abarbanel, he deals with the Talmudic texts and tries to apply them. Okay, so that's just some things about the Chalukah. What time do you have, Mary?
Yeah, 25
minutes. Oh, I'm sorry. Okay, so we'll stop here. We'll continue next week and have a good week.
Thank you very much.